Hello, guys. Welcome to the Blackspin Global Podcast. I am Lucy.
G.
And welcome to a brand new special episode today. I'm so excited. So excited. I'm kind of shy, but I'm really excited. I'm so happy. I can't stop smiling. This is such an honor. We have the one and only Zena Garrison on Blackspin Global Podcast for our International Women's Day special.
Absolute legend of the game. How is
Yes.
Zeta?
I'm great. I'm great. Thanks, Lucy and G, for having me on. And thank you for reminding me about, Women's Month. So this is great.
Oh.
Yeah, no, honestly, it's such an honor because, if we didn't have players like you, this platform would not even exist alone. So
Facts.
it's only right. And as a Black woman myself, I do feel like a lot of Black women are not really celebrated as much during these moments. It's the same names you're hearing, the same stories. So I've been like for months, I told Eugene I want to do something different. I want to highlight the ones that we've had before. So yeah, I'm really glad that we have you on today.
Well, thank you for thinking about me. And it's funny. It's what's funny is that when I realized the older you get, you just kind of people start seeing what they see in front of them all the time, and they kind of go from there. So thank you for thinking about me, and let's have a great talk.
For sure.
Before we get into it though, Zina, we do want to reel off like your career highlights because you had an amazing career. And I do think people do forget that. So yeah, you were a former junior world number one. You won Junior Wimbledon and the US Open in 1981. You reached a career high ranking of world number four in 1989, and you were pretty much a top 10 player for most of your career. You won 14 singles titles and 20 doubles titles, three-time Fed Cup champion as a player. Also, you captained the US Fed Cup team as well. And also, I read that you led the US team at the 2008 Olympics. Is
Yeah,
that
actually,
correct?
I coached, assistant coach in Sydney, and then I coached Greece and I coached Beijing as well. So I've had the fortunate to actually play and then go and coach as well. So I've had a couple of great years being at the.
It's like a fantastic career. Like
Sure.
when we were doing the research, I was saying to Lucy, like I had no idea, like you'd achieved so much because obviously which we'll talk about later on, but. People always talk about the Wimbledon final in 1990 as obviously being the first black woman since Sophia Gibson to reach a Grand Slam final, which we will talk about later on. But I mean, around that, you've achieved so much as well. Like, so yeah, we can't wait to get into all of that, basically. But before we do, we do like to start our interviews of like a quick fire, like, yeah, a couple of questions just to like warm you up. So Lucy, have you got those quick fire questions?
Yes. So we'd love to know your favorite Grand Slam.
Wimbledon, actually.
Okay, yes. Have you, when's the last time you actually went?
I haven't been back in, I think, about almost 10 years now.
Oh wow. Oh
Yeah,
wow.
I've been back
Okay.
with a couple of good girlfriends, and we had a great time, and we're always talking about like, when are we going
We're going back.
back?
That's dope. Favorite surface.
Favorite surface by far, probably my love for grass. Yeah.
Okay. Favorite shot.
Favorite shot would be probably the drop shot.
Okay.
Drop shot with the lob behind it.
Okay.
Go like that.
Like to bring you in and then throw it over there.
Favorite player or players from your era and now?
Favorite player from my era probably would, besides myself, probably would have been Martina Navratilova, just because of the way that she changed the game from athletics to being to what you ate, just the professionalism. Yeah.
Okay.
And today,
And
any
now?
from today?
Today, someone that just left, I still, and that would be Roger Federer, and that's just the overall game. So he's just basically left. I don't yet have one of today of the players because it takes a lot to get me to be behind you.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so now, like, talking about that Wimbledon final, Zina, like, I sorry if you got, because you probably talk about this well, you probably have this question asked you so many times, but hopefully you don't get bored, like, talking about it, because yeah, I mean, it's huge in terms of what you achieved that year. Like, could you take us back to that time, because you were 26 years old.
Yeah, well, now we're going to talk about my age. We ain't talking about my age in a moment. So, it was really weird because in the 1990, I've been playing some pretty decent tennis, but I was also just going through a lot. I had one particular shot that I literally went to start having therapy for because I would miss this ball. I had missed it a couple of times on match points for me once to lead myself into the Grand Slam of the Australian Open. I lost to Mary Jo Fernandez. It was a ball right behind the service line, and it was a short ball, easy ball, and I would dump it in the net, and I did this like three or four times. So I ended up having a therapist that year just to really try to figure out why in the heck was I kept missing this particular shot over and over, and it starts to get into your head so much. So it was kind of weird. So the tournament right before Wimbledon, I actually played Eastbourne. I ended up losing. I don't know who it was, but I lost to someone that was a lot lower than me. Absolutely was ready to quit tennis, like literally. I was like, said to my ex-husband at the time, to my coach, and even my therapist and my trainer, I'm like, I don't even, don't anyone talk to me. I just want to not play, but I love Wimbledon so much. So I gathered myself, and it was really funny because I literally cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner for everybody every day in our flat. And that was how it, like, that was the my it released my pressure. And so I went out there. So I started playing, played my first match, and then I never forget, I got to the quarterfinals and I had to play Monica Seles, and Monica was on a roll. And I think she had won like 34 consistent straight matches and everything. And I was like, once again, I had cooked and woke up in the morning and, go to the grocery store, do all the things. And everybody's like, you're in the quarterfinals, are you crazy? But that was like my peace time. And I had me and Monica were, it was that ball came up and it was in the third set. And literally, Monica, it was match point for Monica. And that ball came up and I hit it down the line and I smacked it for a winner. And I never looked back since then. So then so I never forget looking over to the guy that was my therapist, and it was like, finally, I finally hit that freaking ball. And then I had, so then I knew that I was going to have to play
Any goal.
Steffi Graf. And so it was like, Steffi and I had always had really great matches, but one of my good friends, Lori McNeil, she would always play Steffi really well or beat Steffi. She's like, Zina, just hit to the forehand, open it up to the backhand, get to the net. I'm like, boy, I don't have your volleys. It's not that easy. So I get there and I play that match, end up, have winning the match, hitting the ace on the match point, and I'm so excited. So then I have to play Martina
Wait,
Navratilova.
just wait. Sorry, Zina. We'll back a bit. Steffi Graf was the reigning, well, defending champion at the time.
Yeah, she was, so it was just I mean, I just was on a roll. I just was feeling myself, and my coach was Sherwood Stewart, who I actually won Wimbledon with. And mixed doubles.
Of course.
So, and sure, he would come in and we'd go over strategy all the time, because he was, go and have a drink with the boys and then come back. And, so they would watch the matches before they had all this data on everybody. And so I knew what I needed to do. And so just went out there and I felt really good, playing. And it was on, I always loved playing on center court from the very first time I played on center court. I just loved the intimacy and the warmth of being there. So when I won, so when I beat Steffi, the toughest thing for me was that I was now, my agent said, I was going to get it ready to have a get a contract with the Reebok had been calling. And then I was like, so I was wearing Martina Navratilova's clothes because I didn't have a contract. I'd been in the top 10, top four,
Terrible.
no contract, off the court. And so I was like, well, how do I say to Martina that, you know, it's like, you know, thank you for letting me wear your clothes, but now I got to play you in Reebok, you know? And it's just like, so it was just like, I think I got a message to her or something. It was like, oh, you know, it's cool, you know, no biggie. And I thanked her for wearing the clothes and everything. But then I get to the finals of Wimbledon, getting ready to go on the court, and I hear this strong, beautiful voice, and it was Althea Gibson, and I was like, oh, shit. Like, Althea Gibson came all the way over here to watch me, and I can hear her talking about, you know, this is the locker room that I sat here. This is where
I'm going. Oh, my gosh.
This is how, you know, where is Zena? And I'm just like, oh, my. And before then, I really wasn't. Like, it's almost like an out of body experience. I knew I was doing well, and I knew I was playing well, but didn't really realize how the world was starting to look at, you know, this black tennis player, not since Althea Gibson, but when she came in and I heard her voice, I was like, oh my goodness. Not only have to play Martina Navratilova, who I had lost to 30 something times. One time, then you have the great Althea Gibson walking in talking about what she did years before. So I went out there, I think it was 6-4, 6-1 or whatever, and I tried to play close, and the moment just kind of overtook me. And I tell Martina all the time, it's like, that was your ninth one, you could have gave me one. So it's all good. It's that experience was something else. And I remember talking to my family back home, and then they were telling me there were signs all over and people were so excited. So it was really special.
You also won mixed doubles that year as well, didn't you?
With Rick Leach, which was it was really funny. So I was in the semifinals of all three at one time.
Wow. Yeah.
So, and then I ended up being in the finals of two and then winning one. So it was a great year.
Who are you playing doubles, ladies doubles with?
Patty Fendick. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Wow. Incredible. And then in 1989, you did win the mixed doubles title at Wimbledon as well.
Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, I guess you were very much like acclimatized to like your surroundings, you know, reaching a final of a Grand Slam. Like, obviously a singles and doubles final, they're different, but still, like, it's still major.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, when I won Junior Wimbledon, it's like, and I remember never forgetting that singles match that I played against a girl named Liz Smiling. And I was losing, and I was down like 4-2 in the third or something. And all I could think about was my community, like, had, you know, helped raise all this money to get me here, and everybody has supported me, and I'm literally boohooing on the court. And I came through and I won that match, and then I ended up winning Junior Wimbledon. And I remember when I got home, you guys too young to know this, and picked up the phone, and it was like Ebony Magazine wanted to do an interview, and I'm like,
wow.
Oh, wow.
And so just remember talking and being in Jed and holding up the trophy. So I immediately had a natural love for Wimbledon. See the history, all of that. So for me, winning Junior Wimbledon, it was just like, from then on, I just believed I could play on that court.
Amazing. Love that. Absolutely love that. We're definitely going to come back to some of the things you touched on, like, because I think it's really interesting how you mentioned or referenced the mental coach you had instead of helping you kind of overcome a hurdle in that shot, which we'll touch on later on. But again, just in terms of like your career, Zena, like, what was the most like eye-opening moment for you, like, as a black, it's such an open-ended question, but yeah, as a black woman playing the sport and like navigating the sport back in those days, like, are there any moments that like stand out particularly, like, during your career?
I would say the moment for me that really stood out for me more than anything was, it's kind of a two-part situation. So, and I would say two-part because I ended up being the number one junior in the world, but I went to the French Open juniors. And so I got an opportunity to go there. And then, I don't know how they do it now, but back then, the USTA would decide whether who's going to go to play Wimbledon, who would play the US Open Junior. So you kind of have to get invited. So I got to the quarterfinals of the juniors there. And so I was waiting and waiting to see if I was going to have an opportunity to play Junior Wimbledon. Some people that were a lot lower than me already had gotten the opportunity to play Junior Wimbledon. So it was like, oh, God. So get a chance and get the phone call to play Junior Wimbledon. And I win it. And so then I'm coming to my home country. And I've already done the quarters in one Junior Wimbledon and U.S. Junior U.S. Open. I'm still waiting to see if I'm going to get into the draw when people that I had were beaten. And they got into the draw. So then I get in the draw and I finally win. And then I'm the number one junior in the world. And so that was kind of like really eye-opening for me because it's like didn't matter what I did, who I beat. And I still was always having to be on a wait list. So I kind of used that, you know, I kind of used that and just kind of every time I had an opportunity to get in a tournament, you know, I never forgot those junior moments. And it just pushed me to become the person I am today or back then.
I love that.
How did it feel or how did you handle having to be put in a box as an African-American women's, like, for instance, we did a Arthur Ashe special not too long ago, and I found it interesting how Arthur Ashe is actually the first American man to win the US Open in the open era, but they always mention the first African-American. It's like, yeah, he's African-American, but he's also American. But how did you deal with that?
That literally bothered me for a very long time, that I was always the African-American. I was not the American tennis player. And even though I was breaking barriers as being, you know, not just an American tennis player, I was still doing some, you know, amazing things just for that. And they would always say, but, you know, I was really fortunate enough to have like a lot of people that that were African-Americans that were older. In different sports or different entertainment sections or whatever, that gravitated to my knowledge and pushed me on and helped me not be afraid of that, to use it and to help others. Arthur was amazing with just, you know, just his knowledge and what he did to help my career. And, you know, because my mom wanted me to go to school and Arthur actually came down and talked to my mom because she wanted me to go to college. And he's like, she's beat everybody. Like, she won't go to college. I mean, let her go. And she really wants to go and be pro. But my mom was like, no, she won't go to college. And Arthur just kept saying, but, you know, she has beat everybody. I really think this would be good. So my very first professional tournament was the French Open. And I came on the computer like 27 or 28 or 29 or something. Like,
oh, wow.
That was the first time I came on the computer. And I got to the quarters of the French Open, never saw it again. It was all downhill from there because I was thinking about holding. But, you know, for me, it's just, you know, it was just a stepping stone. And because of my community, that were very passionate about me moving on, becoming the person that they felt that I could become, or the people in my neighborhood and my coach at that time, John Wilkerson. I just always felt like I should be at a certain level. And that's the way, I mean, I think I stayed in the top 10 for like 8 or 9 years or something. And it's like, I was consistent, you know?
Again, on that as well, like, and again, you kind of touched on this earlier when you were talking about Wimbledon and Navratilova basically lending you her clothes. Like, you played a lot of your career without having a sponsor.
Yeah.
Like, it just if you can speak about that as well, and like maybe just talk about how difficult that was, because that must have been not only frustrating, but also, yeah, that would probably costing you a lot of money too, having to fund, you know, equipment and clothing as well to like play in these tournaments?
Well, yeah, well, equipment, like I always got rackets and stuff, but with the clothing. So when I first came out in number one junior in the world, and I had a contract with Pony. It was a clothing company way back then. And so I had that for a while. And then I never forget this. I was in New York, and it was an article that came in this newspaper and said that Pony was going to hire basically a blonde, blue-eyed person. And, you know, and I was like, whoa, like they literally just said that, you know, and that I wasn't going to be the next to have that contract anymore. So my agent said, you know, oh, they're not going to, you know, you'll get something if you get to say four in the world, you'll get a contract. And, you know, it was always something. And so that went on for about 5 years. And I remember there was this like junior agent came to me one time, and the contract was like, I think it was like $50,000 or something like that. They wanted like $50,000 for a couple of years. And the guy like meets me across the street, and he's like, you know, who do you think you are, Michael Jordan or something? And I'm like, no, but I sure think I'm more worth more than $50,000 for a couple of years, and I'm like in the top 10 in the world. Like,
so exactly.
People that are 200 in the world are making way more money. Like, so, you know, that, but those were little things that, you know, didn't anger me, but it drove me, you know, and I always had that, you know, it wasn't cocking, it wasn't arrogant. It was just, I knew my worth. And if not, you know, I figured it'd come around. And my coach had always, John Wilkerson had always told me, you know, just let your racket keep doing the work, keep doing the talk. Yeah. And so that's pretty much what I did. So when I got to the finals of Wimbledon and a Reebok called, and actually I spoke to my agent at that time, and I didn't know that story. Like they, and he told me literally that up until that almost the end of the night and the next morning to the finals, like he had a fight because they was like just trying to give me a 1 month contract. He's like, no.
He's wow.
Like, you know, it's a couple of years of contract and blah, blah, blah. And he just literally told me, I was like, you know, Phil, I didn't even know that story, but you know, it's just kind of interesting. So.
Oh, wow.
Do you feel like much has changed like now in terms of, obviously there are, and we'll talk about this in more detail a bit later on as well, but there are a lot more like black women on the tour, as in pro players now. Most, not all, have clothing deals, but do you feel like things are, well, things have improved, let's say that, but there is still a disparity. Would you agree or not?
Oh no, it's definitely, it's covered up, let me just say.
Yeah.
Well said.
You know, Venus and Serena, they just broke the barriers in so many ways. So and a lot of great barriers, because people do understand that they can, you know, we can sell clothing, we can sell product, we can sell different things. You know, people look at it differently. It's just, you know, the way it's marketed. I think with social media right now, you know, you pretty much can sell yourself as well. So that really helped. I never forget that. When Serena got her first, I think she had already won like three or four Grand Slams, and she still had never had a Fortune 500 contract, which is incredible. Absolutely amazing. And I remember we were at the US Open, and she came, and she sat next to me, and she was so excited. She's like, Zena, guess what? She's like, I got my first deal with the Fortune 500. And I like looked at her like, and I'm thinking like, wow. And, you know, Sharapova is like all over everything. And I remember thinking to myself, like, now here is someone that's won 3-4 Grand Slams. You know, she's definitely going to moving up and is the one to watch and all of this. And then this is her first one. I think it was with IBM, the computer company. And I remember her being so, so, so excited about that and just really never looking back. But, you know, Serena and Venus, both of them have done a great job of really marketing and being their self. And the things that they take on is really pretty much who they are.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well said. Well said.
This is a bit different from players, but in terms of like coaching, there's been a lot of conversation about a lack of coaching, and not even just race, but also lack of coaching. So and not even just like, sorry, probably the accent.
Go there with me. I don't think you want to go there with me.
We're going to go there.
This is a safe space. It's all good. But yeah, you were the first Black woman to captain the US Fed Cup team, now known as BJK Cup. In your opinion, how do you feel like tennis can create more opportunities for women coaches, more specifically Black women coaches as well, and even decision makers? Because a lot of people that are making these decisions or are at the top, you see the same type of faces or same type of race. And a lot of, I find it interesting how, you know, for example, we had a WTA, but you have a lot of white men making decisions.
I was going to say, you have a lot of replays. You see him over here, and then tomorrow you see him over there.
I like that.
But yeah.
Well, it's very interesting because I actually, that very first job that I got, Benny Sims, Chanda Rubin's coach, back in the day, actually called Billie Jean King, and Billie gave me an opportunity to coach. Because and to be her assistant for Fed Cup, not for that opportunity given to me by Billy, because it had already been saying, oh, well, she's never coached before. She's never, you know, this and that.
Yeah.
I mean, since I was picked up a racket, because that was the way I came back. You know, I knew my coach, John Wilkerson, we coached for summer programs. That's what we did. So I knew the game. I could visually see it. I understand it. I love the game. I could watch it. But it was already put in the mouth of everybody. It's like, she's never done this before, whatever. And Billy was like, no. Well, let her be my assistant and let's see. And so I learned a lot from under Billy, but, you know, Billy being Billy, just breaking barriers, you know, just for giving people opportunities for diversity and equality and the whole nine yards. But it was very interesting because when it came behind me, for the people that came behind me to get the job, they didn't have no experience either. And so it was just kind of interesting, but I always just took things as stepping stones. And we by far are still way behind and of diversity in coaching and people having opportunities. And I look at someone like Kamal Murray that coach loaned to a U.S. So Kamal's not coaching right now. Can Kamal coach? Anybody picking up the phone calling him? Like, you know what is the situation, but it's the same old people that you see out there coaching the same old things. And maybe they might have an agent, I don't know, or whatever, but I talk to Mark Parks all the time about that. It's like, y'all ain't calling us either. You know, but it's sometimes it's what you see in front of you all the time, where people are placed and those connections, you 100%. Know, yeah. So, and you see somebody out there, and if you're around and they need somebody, it's like, that's the first thing that they think about, because the people, that's who they see all the time. But sometimes you have to step out and do something different, you know?
Yeah.
And
it was funny because, last year when Francis was going through everything, and so I was talking to Francis and we have conversations and everything, because, you know, he tells me I'm preaching all the time, but I'm like, dude, I need you to come up with it. But, you know, beautiful soul. And so somebody on social media came out that I would be coaching him, and he called me. He's like, I'm like, first of all, sorry about that. I'm like, first of all, I don't want to cut your ass. No. Would I make it? I said, help you? Yes. I said, so we laughed and laughed. But, you know, just the thought of a woman coaching a man and a Black woman, like, that would never happen. Because even in the back of the mind of someone like a Francis or somebody, you know, whatever, it's just like, I'm still a woman and I'm still a Black woman. You really don't see that. Andy Murray is the only
I was
one.
going to say,
Yeah.
Maresma, exactly. Yeah.
That, well, Maresmo, but think about where he came from. His mom was his coach.
True.
Exactly.
So he's
Good
going
point.
into next
Exactly.
season. And so I was about to, where I'm going with that is just even on the smaller circuit, on just the juniors or whatever, if young men and women don't see women going to the next level to coach, then how can they really believe? So that's why, to me, it's all dominated by men because it's what they see at a smaller level from the start. Because then the parents start buying into it. Like, a woman can't coach,
Yeah.
or
It's a great point you make. Visibility, it's very important.
so you have to start. Yeah, and you have to, and we as a culture, meaning the tennis culture, we have to allow that to happen. I'm gonna tell you something that's gonna sound really crazy. Right now, I work in the parks and I'm all over tennis. I have guys all the time telling me I don't know nothing. All the time.
Wow, that's crazy. Wow.
And me just being me, at first I'm like, but then I had to realize it's part of the culture. I'm like, dude, I have not even thought about being, and you're telling me I don't know anything.
Do they know who you are in terms of they know you're Zena Garrison?
Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm still going back to it's the culture. It's still like
That's.
women's tennis is still nothing, even all the great things. For some reason, they feel like it's different. I'm like, is the court the
Insane,
same size?
yeah.
Balls might be a little bit, you may be a little bit faster, but I think the dimensions of the courts are the same. I think you choke just like everybody else choke at those certain
That's
angles.
crazy.
You still miss that forehand volley on top of the net. It's like, hello.
Wow.
Wow.
The only difference between men's and women's tennis is at Grand Slams, the men play five best of five. That's the only difference. But in terms of a product, this is me personally speaking. Right now, I do prefer watching women's tennis over men's tennis. And I see
Facts.
this, I'm just being honest. And I'm a man saying that.
And you say 3 out of 5. Back in the day when we tried and they were trying to see if we could play 3 out of 5, we could do it if we want to. But heck, if we ain't gotta do it, why do it? Now that's the part where I take and be a privileged woman. Thank you. I'm just being real. The situation, it's just one of those things, but the bottom line of it, the court is still the same. The
Facts.
stroke is still the same. Even if your serves might be a little bit more powerful or whatever, but I still go back to the mental part and the mental part and the court dimensions are the same. Until they check that, then don't talk to me about what I can see and what I can help with, because it's still the game of tennis.
Even on power as well, like there's all sorts of like, well, stats available now. Like when you're watching Grand Slams, for instance, you often see stats of like the hardest hitters, and
Yeah.
oftentimes it's women that are hitting harder than the men, both forehand
Yeah.
and backhands. The serve, it's still the men hitting the bigger serves, but the ground strokes, it's the women are up there, like hitting just as big as the guys, like
I mean, I would put Sabalenka against any of them with power
Or
forward.
Madison Keys,
Yeah.
exactly.
Or Madison. Yeah. But it's just, like I said, it's just the way that our culture and the way that we think and a way the way the way they think. And I mean, let's be real, the world, not just America, but the world has not caught up to, most things are just, it's mentally how you
Yeah.
look at it.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And staying with like the decision makers, how important do you feel like it is to have someone like Portia Archer, who's now the CEO of the WTA, a woman,
Yeah,
a
no,
black woman?
you don't know. First of all, someone sent it to me as a text, so I'm like, Portia, like I didn't know yet that she's black, right? And in my mind, I'm like being a little bit, like, I'm like a black name. I slipped a little short through my head. So I said, Portia. And then I read a little bit further. I was like, oh, a black woman. I was like, oh my goodness, this is so great. So I immediately got off the phone and I immediately called Alana and Billy, and because I had saw in there that she did something with Women's Sports Foundation, and Billy was like, do you see she's a black woman? I was like, Billy, I read. Like, Billy's more excited than me. Like, Billy's like, women just need a chance. Everybody needs a chance. She's going, everybody needs a chance, Billy. And I said, Billy. And so I was like, oh, I said, I would love to meet her. I still haven't had a opportunity. But I hear she's doing great things. So, but the first thing that runs through my mind is that she needs true support. When true support, because there's a lot of things. Being a black woman in an all-white sport, you need shields. You need to understand the shields that might not look the same. They might come at you one way, you think they're good, but you need a shield. And then just woman shield, nothing. Dean, I'm sorry, nothing against
No,
you.
that's fine. That's fine.
Woman shield, because you gotta know, you gotta know who might be coming after you just because you're a woman.
That's true.
Very, very well said. But and also on pole vault, obviously Porsche's doing amazing things at the WTA, but not on a global scale, but from a US perspective, we did have Katrina Adams being the president of the
Trina was
USTA
here
too.
the other day.
Oh,
Oh, you have to go
like.
on and look at my Instagram. I think it's still up today, and look at my dog, because I made some fried chicken because we were doing the little boycott thing here in the States, and so you're not supposed to, wasn't supposed to buy anything. So Katrina happened to be visiting people, so it was so cute. And my dog loves chicken, and she was wearing Katrina out because she wasn't giving her any. And Katrina's like, "You're not giving her." And Katrina's still on. And the dog was going, so you have to look at that.
No, definitely
That's so
we'll be looking
cool.
at that. But yeah, if you can talk about the significance of having someone like Katrina Adams as well leading the USTA, like in some ways for me that has kind of led to a Portia Adams now, being at the top of the WTA. Like, would you agree or?
Yeah, well, I would say it opened the doors. So it made it visible. It made a thought possible. If anything, I could be wrong, it's just my opinion. The Venus and Serena, just the way that they handled things and opened the door, it just opened up a lot. I think that probably helped more for someone like a Portia. And what I mean, because they're business women, but they also, great ambassadors for different things and whatever. So in the WTA, and just the way people react to them on the circuit, I think that allowed someone like a Portia to be very busy. And Katrina had a small portion in that as well, because it just sees that it's possible. And then let's be real about it. Whether people like it or not, it's a lot of diversity in tennis,
It
especially
is.
women's tennis. Yeah.
Especially that it's such a global sport and people are traveling. But I think at times we forget that, like, it's still very, very diverse, especially compared to a lot of different sports. Like, we're watching tennis tournaments happening in countries that we've never been at. So, yeah.
I never forget, Venus said to me one time, we were in Russia at a Fed Cup match. And so we did a clinic, and it was like all these little girls that looked back then looked like Kournikova and Sharapova, and they had their little gown, their little shirt. I mean, it was like they were trained, had their little dresses on, and everybody looked like a little doll. And the guys, very strong, and these are young kids. And then Venus looked, and she's like, "We're in trouble." And I just thought about it. I was like, yeah, because all of them could hit. But the thing that struck me the most was like, most of them live in one bedroom shacks. It's like being in the hood, Zena. She's like, they're trying to get out. And I was like, that's a good one. But those countries, that is true. They're trying to get out. They're trying to escalate. It was no longer just a serious country club if you had money. It's just like the whole world changed, and that seeing it a way out.
Yeah,
For sure.
it's a great point. Again, Zina, like, we're kind of going back and forth here a bit, but
it's all right.
I feel as well, you don't give yourself enough credit in terms of the players that we see today. Like, you are a big reason, like, for a lot of the players we see on the tour today, especially from a black perspective, let's just be real. And of course, Venus and Serena did amazing things in their careers. Venus still hasn't officially retired yet. She's still an active player.
So, no,
we can't talk about Venus like she's retired because she hasn't retired. But
Sarah was supposed to be in Harriet Wells, and then I was like, what the? And then I read, woke up the next morning, I said, she didn't even know she was playing. I'm like,
she didn't know. She was like, I'll find out just like you guys. You were like, what?
Incredible scenes.
I text her sister. I'm like, what the heck? Really going out here.
So the players we have today, like, were Sloane Stephens, Madison Keys, Coco Gauff, like, all Grand Slam winners in their own right. Francis Tiafoe, who you mentioned, also a friend of the pod as well. Shouts out to Francis. Like, you've kind of paved the way for those players as well, like, in a sense. Like, how it must fill you with so much pride, like, seeing these players now, like, at the top of the game today. Like, if you can talk a bit about that.
And, like, well, yeah, the interesting thing is, it's kind of hard to sit there and be, I never would be the one patting myself on the back of what I did, but as you get older, you start thinking about it. And for me, it was always, I never won a Grand Slam singles title. It took a lot for me to start grasping that. And that's what I love about these younger players. You won a Grand Slam, you won a Grand Slam. You know, and I won three Grand Slam titles in mixed doubles. So I was playing against a man and a woman. So it's like, you know, and so I'm saying all that to say, I love the way the younger players, like, if they win a Grand Slam, like I'm so happy right now for Taylor. Like, she's starting to really, really, you know, come into her own. And I coached Taylor for almost 2 years. And Taylor actually lived with me for about 2 years till I kicked her out. No, just kidding. We got tired of each other. But, you know, I'm really proud. I'm really proud of what she's doing right now. But she always knew that she wanted to be to be a great doubles player and also singles player, but she wanted to let people know that you could do it, you know. I'm a Grand Slam champion, and I love the way she is. She's letting the world know, it's like, I am a champion. Because in our world of tennis, sometimes it's like, you're not enough unless you win a Grand Slam singles. But now, finally, I think the world is catching up. And I think that's because of social media. You're also allowed to make sure that the world knows that you're doing well and put yourself out there and whatever. And I'm loving that doubles is starting to get a lot more attention. They got a heck of a lot more money. It's just all coming into play. But, you know, it's so true. If you've won a Grand Slam in anything, and at one of the Grand Slam tournaments, I mean, that's a major, major accomplishment.
Facts.
I won three. And a gold medal and a bronze medal. So I wasn't bad.
Speaking of doubles, we're planning to ask that later, but the way that you're going on about it now, I'm curious. So now I'm curious to know, I'm pretty sure you're aware of the new mixed doubles US Open change room. What are your views and opinions on the new changes that are going to happen this year?
Well, first of all, I'm old enough to know if they've already put it out there, it's going to happen. So it's good. But as being a 3-times Grand Slam champion, I think there is something to the fact of the fact that it's in the middle of the tournament. And so I saw something the other day. It's like, you know, but this way we put it in front that you would get some of the top men players to play and whatever. I'm not a fan of slicing things off just for people to get another nick in a notch, I should say. Because if you really wanted to play, then you'll play.
Facts.
But the money, now that's a whole nother thing. But from what my understanding with this, it's going to be certain people picked. So it's really a big exhibition.
Yeah.
And then should they really get the title of a Grand Slam at the U.S. Open? Mixed doubles, because you're not planning doing the tournament.
It's a tough one.
I'm with you.
Started out last year, because I was thinking last year when they did the little exhibition thing, and I think Tsitsipas
and Badosa,
they won it. Yeah. And I was like, where are they going with this? Well, now we know where they're going.
Now we know. That's true.
Do you think the Grand Slams are going to follow suit? Like, so it won't just be the US Open, Wimbledon, French, Australia. Do you think they'll follow suit? Because I do. I feel so
most
much
of
the time.
Yeah. I mean, they do. So somebody did. And then another thing is everybody is trying to one-up everybody on how much money, this person gets, or how many fans come in every year. That's the big thing. It's like a one-up. But, I'm a big component for some change, but it always has to be always changing something to make sure that you get some of the top players. Like, if you're a really top player, and this is a pet peeve of mine, is it's so much more strenuous, the game, blah, 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 whatever. Of course, the same. Y'all are in the backcourt hitting bam, bam, bam. You know how hard it is to serve and volley constantly. You know what I'm saying? It's, it's like, okay. But I guess what I'm saying is it's just more taxing on your body, but it's also, it's still a mental thing more than anything. It's the stress. Yeah. The stress is what really brings on more, because now you make more money, you got to rely more on your sponsorships, blah, blah, blah. We now have betting in the thing. Then we got a coach just sitting right there talking your ear off 24/7. I mean, it's the stress.
This feels like have you seen our questions, Zena? Because it feels like you're just like segueing into like each question.
I'm just old.
Honestly, because you're talking about like, mental health. That's literally our next question.
I was a mental health player, so I know most tennis players are mental health. They might not tell you, but all of us have had therapy in some type of form or something.
And this is incredible. But on that, so Naomi Osaka, she's probably the most famous player that
also she was even the first
first. Paula Badosa as well, she's also spoken about her like mental health struggles. On the men's side, Andrei Rublev, the Russian, he has as well. It feels like today people, just in general, like across society, people are much more open to talking about mental health compared to like back in the 90s or like even the 80s. Like, it probably wasn't even really a thing.
Like, oh, no. It was a thing.
In terms of people speaking openly about it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't. But I should say, but back then, you must remember, we were always taught to don't give up too much because it might help your opponent. Your opponent knows. They grow in the era where everything's out there anyway. And then it's just a whole nother era with everybody got a phone. So you can't even walk into a doctor's office or some, set up an appointment with somebody without somebody might knowing that you walked in there. Your social media page. But the pressure on the athlete is just so much more stronger. I give credit to Naomi. I give a lot of credit to Naomi for just saying, hey, I don't want to do no interviews. Like, she got roasted for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously roasted.
At the French, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then people, and, I know even for me, it's like, just having an eating disorder all the years, it's like, she has a mental problem. It's just, mental problem because I got an eating disorder. Okay. But then back then it also affected your insurance. So there's a lot of like things that go with it. So you can't, so you have to be careful. But now Naomi does that. People still to this day, is she whatever, knowing that everybody on that court got some type of problem or something that needs some therapy. But then because of that, I guarantee you, Simone Biles, it came right up and she took it to another level at the Olympics. Who stepped away and said, I can't do it?
Yeah, that's true.
What happens again? The media tried their best to like destroy that.
Destroy.
But for the athlete, it's a good thing because they're taking their power back in that form. I just wish that some of these younger athletes realize that, you know, still, in my opinion, still sometimes a little bit selfish in what they're doing. Sometimes we do need to know some things a little bit earlier so it doesn't blow up and the press can kind of take it off. If you need a break, you need a break.
Yeah. It's okay.
You know, or you have that. One of the worst things I just recently saw was you guys' little player over there, Ronda Kondo. What's her name?
Emma Raducanu.
Emma Raducanu, yeah.
I mean, I see her walking over and she looks like she's having in a panic attack. You know, she goes behind and then she's, I guess some guy was in the stands.
Yeah, in the stands, whatever. Yeah.
Like, can you imagine? And then the next day, it's like, she's having a panic attack and all these things. And not even the next day, things are being thrown off and you don't even know. I didn't know.
Yeah.
You didn't even know the facts. It just looked like she was having a nervous breakdown there. But if somebody's back there and I felt that person was coming after me or been following me too, I would have freaked out too.
Mm-hmm.
And all this to say, so it's a lot. They got a lot more stress. They got a lot more things to watch. There's a lot of crazy people out here.
Yeah.
You know, and I know I had a guy who ended up in jail. Had to get the FBI and involved and everything, stalker, blah, blah, blah. So it is a very weird feeling. I'm literally in Miami Beach one day, time playing a tournament. I'm walking out of the stadium late at night. Somebody hits me in the head. Then the security grabs me. And then I don't like crowds to this day. I mean, so there's a lot of things, you know, we're athletes, but we're still human.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think that's often it's forgotten. Yeah. Like people just think you're like superheroes just because you're professional athletes, but you are
well,
just
they
human
feel
beings.
Like they know you. They feel like you're part of them. Mm. They feel like you only know me from what I show.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. Yeah.
No, well said, you know. And again, we've spoken about doubles again, like you said. We did forget to mention during your like reading out your career highlights. You did mention you've won Olympic gold and bronze. So apologies for missing that out at the beginning. But yeah, your doubles career is just like it's Hall of Fame level, really and truly.
Mm-hmm.
And you've spoken quite passionately about doubles. And again, Taylor Townsend too. Like she's now kind of dominating women's doubles, being the current world number two, and her partner being number one or most frequent partner. Like it, in terms of doubles now, how it's viewed in tennis, like do you feel like it could ever kind of match singles, or do you feel like singles will always be the kind of number one or go-to product when it comes to tennis?
I think it's always singles will always be number one, but I think doubles is, I think because people in doubles are now starting to market themselves because of social media. So it's getting out there, you know, Taylor has a pretty good following, you know, and she speaks out, you know, her voice. So I think, you know, and when Coco was, you know, coming up, it was the way that the world really got an opportunity to see her through her doubles when she was still coming.
That's a great
she
point. Came up,
taken to number one. And most people don't realize, but like Venus and Serena, like, that helped them, branched them on. You know, they won a lot of doubles titles before, and that really made people. So I think people are starting to coaches are starting to understand that it also helps the game, but it's so much more, it's so much money into it now that it's easier to say, get your butt back out there and play, you know, rather than, oh, go ahead and default, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's a whole thing. And then we talked about this too. Now, any title, any Grand Slam title is good.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Some of these people are winning Grand Slam titles for their countries, and, you know, that's major.
It's huge, definitely.
Definitely, yeah. And how was the experience of like coaching Taylor Townsend and then now seeing where she is now?
Taylor was young, so I think when I got a hold of Taylor, she was probably like 563 in the world, and then
Wow.
like in 6 months, we had her at 63 in the world. So it's like she made a huge jump. But the great thing about Taylor is an incredible competitor. I mean, she competes. I'm very close
Got
with
that
her.
dog in her, as you say.
And what used to make me, what upset me a lot back then with Taylor is that people talked about her outside, the way she looked or whatever. I'm like, y'all not up at 7 o'clock in the morning watching this girl work out, or 8 or 9 o'clock. Like she puts in the work, and she understands she's competitive. She's all of those. So working with her was with Taylor was interesting. I didn't want to coach. She kept begging me because she knows I don't really like to fly. She kept begging me till I did it. And we parted ways. It's like, I felt at that moment she wasn't, growing up and being professional. It's like, so made the decision like, hey, I'm telling you, in order to get where you want to go, you need to do this and you need to be more professional. She just wasn't ready. She was young. So it's nice to see, I think, the birth of her child, I
Yeah.
think, help her grow up in a lot of ways as she sees things. But the thing about her has always been her competitiveness. She's going to compete every time she goes on there. And I remember watching her play one match, and it was, I think she was the second or the third round. She played Cornet at the French Open, and I was like in with the French crowd, and I'm like, this girl can play. Just the stuff that we had gone over, and using her drop shots, mixing the shots up, doing whatever, she did it to the T, ended up winning that match. And you see certain players. That it's like if they can just put it together professionally, they're gonna have a good career in something. But she's always wanted people to see doubles as a great sport, and she's always wanted to dominate it, which she's on the way. So.
For sure, oh, for sure. It's funny because I was going to ask you, would you ever be interested or look to even coach a little bit? But from that, your answer is given, I am not coaching again. Oh.
What I love to do is I love to give training blocks. That's, they come in and we work a little bit and whatever.
Okay.
That's fine. It's funny because Serena, right before she retired, we always talked about, I would be like, can I just teach you how to volley just a little bit, And I remember during the pandemic, I get this phone call. Well, first of all, I'm looking at my phone because she would always text me, and I'm like, Serena, what she calling me for? She's like, what you doing? I'm like, it's the middle of the damn pandemic. What you think I'm doing? I'm sitting at home. And she's like, yeah, would you be interested in just coming down and working out? I said, Serena, I don't play no more. She told me, no, let's just come train me. Teach me how to volley a little bit. I'm like, what? So I literally went down there. I was supposed to be for 1 week. And I was like, I gotta get my COVID shot, but then I gotta come back and get my COVID shot. So
What a time.
I ended up staying 6 weeks or whatever. We had a great time, but and just to watch her, from seeing her as this 7-year-old kid and being her mentor from when she came on, and then the greater champion that she is, and then spending those 6 weeks with her, I'm like, God, just her, the way her schedule, and she had it all locked down. And when she shuts down, she shuts down, and she's two different people, but it's like you need that. Like she learned professionalism was unfreaking believable. And she was another one that she, another thing that she told me that I didn't get. And I passed this when I started working with Taylor. And I was having a conversation with her about Taylor. And she said, and it was about social media. And she said, Zena, the next true champion is going to have to learn to do social media and be a champion. She's like, you can't get away from it. She's like, that's the world. And I never forget that conversation. I was like, she's so right. And then, because it's part of your sponsorship, it's part of the world, it's part, you have to be able to cope. And that insight of that was just, that she saw that That's to be the next champion. You have to do all of that. And you look at someone like Alcaraz or, you know, Francis or whatever, you know, any of these guys, it's like you have to be able to manage all of that. You got to be.
It's a package. Yeah.
And then they got to be able to manage their team, which is another 5 or 6 deep over there, which is a whole nother thing. And I don't, you know, it took me a while with the coaching on the court and stuff. And then with the Australian Open, putting them right on the court. Like,
you like that?
Well, let me say this. I was thinking about Madison and how I've watched so many matches, you know, oh, come on, Madison. It didn't happen for her. And I've thought about, you know, the Wimbledon match and she was just right there, and, you know, and it's like, well, what if they were closer? Well, then think about it. Her coach was right there that you can actually, she probably could really feel it. So she didn't have an opportunity. I mean, you could really feel the present. Yeah. You didn't have an opportunity to start letting your mind wander. So somebody like her, I think it worked. But for somebody like me, it probably wouldn't have been good. I'd be like, take your butt up there and leave me the hell alone. I'm in this. Hell, I was now when they was up there and they weren't supposed to be coaching. I'm like, shut up.
You set up the Zena Garrison Foundation as well, like staying on the coaching theme. You set up a foundation, was it 1992?
Yeah, and actually, right after the pandemic, lasts about another year, and I'm actually getting ready to bring it back in a smaller form because it's 30 something years old. But it was just too hard to raise money for donations. It's just tougher, and the further and further you get out, people don't know who you are. It's just, you know, you don't, I don't want to say the, well, it's the only way to say it, but you know, the power, you know, it just got tougher and tougher to raise money. But I'm trying to bring it back just in a smaller way because I need it for me, not for anything else. It's just like, I enjoy seeing that little kid hit their first ball, you know, just smile, you know what, I don't want to be on court all the time, but I want to raise the money so that you know, people can pass.
Are you doing some mentoring at the moment, or is that not something you're doing?
No, actually right now work for the city of Houston. I work for the Parks Department. What? So I oversee all the tennis in Houston, and we do have a beginners and intermediate tennis program that allows kids to pick up the racket for the first time and see if they want to play. But what we're still missing is just, you know, kids having the opportunity, you know, if you only have a little money or have some money or whatever, then, you know, you can still move up. And we don't have that here. Yeah. You know, CGA, that's what you know, at least I would have, you know, 40 and 50 kids. If they wanted to keep playing, they could still get good lessons, because it's still very expensive. It's expensive, especially you got 2 or 3 kids in your family, 4 kids, it's really expensive. And then so many tournaments, and you know, it's just an expensive sport still.
It is.
More power to you, and yeah, like all the best with that. I'm sure that will continue to grow and grow, like when you do start it up again.
Well, it's interesting because it's like I said, it's really for me more than anything. Because it gives me joy, and especially what's going on in the world today, more and more, it still comes back to the community. And I know that I was very blessed. My community, you know, made me who I was, who I am, and it also makes me want to keep passing that on. I mean, I had a lot of people that invested in me and others. And my friends are in different things, but we all, because of that little court at McGregor Park, our community invested in us and instilled us. You know, you got doctors, lawyers, architects, owners of companies, I mean, musicians. I mean, all of that because a guy by the name of John Wilkinson and his friends had a place for kids to come and learn tennis. And it didn't matter if you're Black, white, Hispanic, rich, or not. I tell people all the time, I met 2 billionaires sitting right on the bench, and playing tennis at the park that I grew up in. And it's like, you know, and I never forget, I don't remember their names, but I remember one of them said to me, do something that you love and be passionate about. You don't ever have to worry about money.
Powerful. It's very powerful.
So, because it's going to come back to you some way or another.
For sure.
But I don't know if you know about the times we're going through now, but.
Being a billionaire, you didn't feel it. But yeah, that's
at this point, I'm like, should I leave here or what? I got over there. For sure. I got to get a visa to come.
Well, you have to come to Wimbledon, Zena. Like, you have to come.
You've been reading the way these planes fly coming out the air over here. Ever since we got somebody else over here, it's been crazy.
No comment.
Exactly.
I'm at the wait to things just get it. I was supposed to do an event actually tomorrow, it's going to be the 75th year of Althea Gibson. And actually, Katrina is going to be moderating. When she came here the other day, she said, oh, so I'll see you on Monday. I said, Katrina, now you know I don't like to fly. You think I'm about to get a shot? She said, I was thinking about that. She said, that ain't going to get a, you know, I was all ready to go, but normally I don't have my panic attacks until 2 days out. I started having panic attacks a week ahead. I said to the lady, I said, True, trust me, I really want to come. She's like, well, you better be at the open even if you got to drive. I'm like, I will be at the open even if I got to drive, but right now I can't make that plane.
we'll help you do, because we'll be there. So it will be such a nice time to see you. And
I'm going to cry. I will be driving even if I need to come, but I love the open, so definitely hook up.
100%.
Well, I think that's a great way to end it, Zena, man. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.